Welcome back to my house, Rosie on the house. Rosie and Romy and Dr. David Dean of Grand Canyon University, professor of history, here talking about the National Historic Preservation Act of 1966 and what it does for individual properties and entire neighborhoods. And we've seen right here in Arizona what it's done to preserve and, in fact, in my opinion, completely revitalize certain pockets of downtown.
Right. In terms of Phoenix, Phoenix actually preserves, percentage-wise, more eligible properties than the cities of Philadelphia, Boston, and Atlanta.
Now, an interesting thing, it has to be 50 years old. We have a whole bunch of houses that are just aging up to that period of candidacy. I mean, we can't just keep stamping more every community that's 50 years old as significantly historic, can we?
No, and that's a real challenge for preservationists because how do you select from all that housing stock? Remember that Phoenix is explosively growing in the post-World War II period. The GI Bill is bringing people out here. Industries like Motorola and Intel are bringing people here. City's growing in population from about 125,000 to 500,000 people in a 10-year period of time. So that's all new houses. And you know where those houses are. The 44th Street and Camelback and Indian School area. They're over in the Northern and 35th Avenue area. They're all around the valley. And so there's 250,000 or so homes in that stock. And how do you pick the best 10%, 5%, 1% of those to go onto that National Register to be an example of what housing was like in the late 1950s and early 1960s?
And there's an era, I will tell you, that from about 65 to 80, we probably shouldn't register any of them.
Well, those are good block-constructed homes.
Well, that was just the time we reduced the block use, and we started putting them up in 2x4s. We were using single-pane windows, aluminum. I mean, there were a lot of things we were doing in that era. We just shouldn't celebrate.
Doing math. So that's a 1966. Doesn't seem that far back when you start looking at homes. But what's really funny is if you fast forward 50 years and you're talking about 200,000 homes now, well, in 50 years, there's going to be 6 million stucco homes with tile roof. No one's going to say, wow, that was some historic, great building. Gosh, we were doing it so good then.
But one of the things, and preservationists have to think about that. When we think about those houses, 65 to 75, 81, well, what, 80, 81, we start to get the vaulted ceilings and roofs some of those kind of changes. But, yeah, you're right, T111 on the siding houses and those Wood Brothers homes, Suggs homes, these names kind of come about.
Yeah.
So what do you take the best of those examples. In the earlier period, John F. Long homes, Maryvale. You know, Maryvale is an area that's always in kind of transition lately.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we can go in there with preservation, we can select a good John F. Long neighborhood, and we can help homeowners there take advantage of tax incentives, take advantage of city exterior rehabilitation money to put into their homes. We can make an investment in those neighborhoods. It can turn them around. And so preservation can be a catalyst not only for making places beautiful in preservation, but they can also stabilize neighborhoods and bring communities together, bring about that civic pride about the neighborhoods that they live in and stuff. So it's really a great community thing, not just something for property owners to get an advantage or have a nice house.
Well, John F. Long, I don't think people realize how innovative he really was. He was ahead of his time, and he built as good a starter home as anybody in this town.
And the challenge of his homes were they were actually designed to be modified over time.
Mm-hmm.
There's a starter home. Here's the basic bones of a home. And if you want to add on to it later on, or if you want to close in the garage. And so those all become factors that preservationists now have to weigh as is that an appropriate thing or not. Of course, his innovation with building trusses off-site and bringing them on, block-constructed homes, floor plans that are pretty, about 900 to 1,200 square feet or so.
Yeah.
I mean, just incredible what he did to build these communities. Of course, Del Webb does the same thing with Sun City.
Right.
And again, these are all bringing former service personnel, these people out here to the West, and cities like Phoenix and San Diego and Tucson and Denver and Los Angeles all have to deal with this post-World War II housing boom. And again, how do you select it? How do you pick those best examples?
Boy, and I got in just at the tail end of all of those, where we would build entire subdivisions before we would sell one house. We would never put up a cul-de-sac of model homes. We would just build all 300 homes. And then you just open the gate one Saturday morning, and people just run in and they hang soul stickers on the doorknobs. And that's how you picked your house.
Yeah. That was the housing boom back in those days.
Well, the builders were really spoiled. We didn't have to change one thing. You know, now somebody buys a model home and then kind of semi-customs it up. You know?
Right.
And so no two homes are exactly alike. Oh, baby, back in the 50s and 60s, every home was exactly alike. You could frame the home in your sleep.
Well, and you go all the way back to the kind of the first one of those kind of neighborhoods back in New York, in Levittown, which were those that mass-produced kind of little house, about 800 square feet, and they all look alike. But that was part of the conformity of the 1950s. That was part of the culture of our 1950s. That's what we did. We didn't buy custom homes. We didn't do all that stuff. We had these little neighborhoods, and we went to work 9 to 5, and we took our kids to the park on Saturdays, and we owned our two cars in the garage, and mom went to the shopping mall, and all that stuff, that post-war prosperity.
The homes were $8,500, and the cars were $1,400, right?
Yeah. Oh, for those days again.
Oh, man.
And you can't buy one of those historic homes for anything close to that. There's a move-in price, but I tell you what, we talk about the joy factor, the quality of life factor that has no value. You can't put a value on those unique neighborhoods for quality of life.
Property owners that enjoy living in historic districts, they're so proud of their homes. They open them up once a year for those historic home tours. They have them in Glendale. They have them in Phoenix. They have them in Mesa. They have them in Tempe. They have them in other cities. We'll have these historic home tours where you can go in and you can see the details, the wood floorings, the moldings on the edges, just the details in houses that we don't see anymore.
The last historic home we actually remodeled was for a widow down in the Willow District, and it took us about 4 times longer to do that job than it should have, because every time I'd go there, she and I would sit down and start visiting, and she was a wife of a serviceman, and she watched the entire attack of Pearl Harbor from the window of her shower. She was in the shower when the attack started, and she watched the entire attack out this window. And she just had story after story. My guys would show up, and she and I would be in the kitchen sipping coffee for like an hour and a half.
Hopefully they weren't on the clock.
They were on the clock, my clock. But it was just one of my favorite projects we were ever involved in. When we get back, we're going to talk more about some of the favorite historic buildings in Arizona.
Pick up this Saturday edition of the Arizona Republic for Rosie's Home Improvement Column, where we cover the most important topics that every homeowner needs to know.